All right, we'll bring the meeting for today to order. So let's know, Emma, have you looked at the minutes?
I absolutely not, Mr. Chairman. Would you like me to look?
I would like you to, briefly. From the March 8th meeting. Now I know who to not call on for this.
Yeah, right.
Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, you might want to find someone else. It might take me just a few minutes to go through.
Okay. No, well, why don't you do that? We'll hold off on that. Okay. So, Representative Huntley moves House File 736 that it be recommended to pass and be referred, and I know I have that here. Where? To the floor. Okay. To the General Register, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, this relates to a ambulance service personality longevity award, which is an incentive program to get people to be basically volunteer EMT people, and this relates primarily to outside the huge metro areas. Most of the metro areas have professional emergency medical people, and in the rural part of our state, we depend on volunteers for that. And I must say that I've always been a city boy until so the first time I was elected in 92, and about 40% of my district was townships, and at that time I did not know what a township was, to be honest. And it was an educational experience, and I thought, well, if you got friendly with the township officers, that was it, you know, and you could win elections. And I soon found out that in townships, basically nobody likes their township officers. It's who they dislike the least is what counts. But what really is the heart and soul of a township is the volunteer fire department and the volunteer EMT people, and that is really the township community. And it's very difficult, however, to get people to volunteer. Obviously, if you're going to be an EMT, you have to take a lot of training. And it's volunteer, so there's no great amount of pay. And what has been set up over the years is basically a small stipend for them if they stay as a volunteer firefighter or volunteer EMT. They get a very small pension. Two of the people most instrumental in setting that up were Roger Cooper, who was a House member from Bird Island, or is that Yellow Medicine County, and Dallas Sams, a senator from the west central part of the state, were very active in setting this program up, which has been effective, but I would say that actually, again, we're having trouble getting volunteers, and we may have to do something in the future. So what this bill does is simply name that program for these two former legislators. Senator Sams, as most of you know, died this past week, and Roger Cooper is not well either. So with that, we have a gentleman here to testify in favor of it, O.J. Doyle, and he can give you a little better detail.
Mr. Doyle.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is O.J. Doyle. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Ambulance Association and EMS providers around the state. I think that Representative Huntley pretty much nailed it. There's really not much more to say. As I was saying to Representative Huntley, there's many more people in the legislature now, and there will be in the future, some of whom are sitting here, who will be instrumental in the survival of the EMS safety net throughout the state. These two individuals are no longer in the legislature and are both, one passed away, the other in ill health. And we just feel this would be a fitting tribute to them and to memorialize their efforts.
All right. Any questions, members? All right. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, can we change the motion to the consent calendar?
It can't
Laura? Or Mercer Broad? Do we do a consent calendar on this one?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Representative Emmer was talking about amendments on this bill, and I got... I got worried.
Thank you. Can we do a consent calendar on this today?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's any problem.
Representative Huntley renews his motion or amends his motion that House Bill 736 be recommended to pass and sent to the consent calendar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just have one other thing to remind people about Roger Cooper. Occasionally at the end of sessions, somebody gets up and says the Hennepin County delegation will meet in room 10, and then the Ramsey County delegation, somebody will get up and said the Ramsey County delegation will meet in room 5, and Roger Cooper about once a year would get up and say the Yellow Medicine County delegation will meet in room 335. He was the Yellow Medicine County delegation.
Members, all in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the minutes from the March 8th meeting.
All right, and thank you for taking a look at them, too. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you. House File 707, Representative Howe. We'll move that House Bill 707 be recommended pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. What is the most bill I heard in all week?
No.
Since my 4 years here. Okay, I have some prepared notes. I'll read it to make it look like I know what I'm talking about. Access to dental care has been a persistent problem for people with disabilities for many years. Fiscal access to dentist's office often stops many people with disabilities at the door because they can't get in. Historically, low reimbursement rates by medical assistants have limited the number of dentists willing to serve this population. And these problems are more severe in rural areas where the supply of dentists is limited. House File 707 would ask the Department of Human Services to study this important problem. We'll look at fiscal accessibility issues to determine what can be done. And we'll look at geographic access to see if certain parts of the state are doing better or worse than others. And they also look at payment rates. While positive steps have been made in this area, it would be good to know if they are working. So I have with me Mr. Cheetah and Heidi. She's been here several times. So Mr. Cheetah.
Mr. Cheetah.
Thank you, Representative Tao. Mr. Chair and members, I think Representative Tao spoke very well to the issues.
And just please admit, say your name for the record.
John Cheetah from Curt Center, and also representing the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. We're about a 100-member cross-disability coalition. The issue of dental access is one that has affected our constituency for some time. As Representative Tao said, part of this problem is a physical problem. In accessing dental offices and making sure that dental chairs and equipment are there to serve our population. Certainly reimbursement rates have historically challenged our population as well. I think rather than have me talk about the problems, I'd rather have Heidi talk about her situation, and I would stand for any questions.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Heidi Meyer. I live in Dakota County in the city of West St. Paul. I would like to tell you about the medical assistance MA dental care problems going on with me and others. I was born in Minnesota with a disability and dental problems and was adopted as a baby. My dad and mom paid for lots of dental work and surgery to keep my mouth healthy. And as I became a grown-up, I needed help from the Health and Human Services of Minnesota. My dad signed me up for Medical Assistance MA. One of the things I got from Medical Assistance MA was dental care. When I was in the state hospital for 8 months, I saw the dentist one time under Medical Assistance MA. Then after the state hospital, I went to a group home. One of the group home staff helped me get my dentist that would take medical assistance and lay people. I started to see the dentist on May 5th, 1989. My medical assistant's medical van took me to the dentist. After living in two group homes, I moved into an apartment. September 19, 2000 was the last time I saw the dentist. I received a letter in the mail explaining why I could no longer use this dentist. The dentist dropped me because a lot of work the dentist did comes from people in nursing homes. The dentist dropped low-paying dentist plans and medical assistant dental plans at the office all together. I saw the dentist for 11 years and 4 months before being dropped. Then I had to find a new dentist. I looked in the phone book to find a new dentist that would take me and medical assistants and me close to where I live. I found lots of dentists in the phone book that would not take me or my medical assistant, M.A. Then I found one looking in the phone book that would take me and my medical assistant, M.A., close to my home. I started to see the dentist on April 10th, 2001. My medical assistant, Van, took me to the dentist. And when I was there, the dentist office, the dentist was telling me he was thinking of dropping medical assistant dental plan. I asked the dentist if it was the $500 copay put into place to pay all the dental care. The dentist said it was no pay he gets back from all the work he does, and the $500 does not help at all. I told one of my workers, and she did not believe me in what I was saying about the dentist dropping medical assistance dental plans. I then called my... I then called the dentist up for an appointment. The front desk person asked what plan was on, and I told my medical assistant and me. She said they no longer took medical assistant and me, and that is how I found out that I did not have a dentist. September 14, 2003 was the last time I saw that dentist. I talked to my financial worker about what had happened. The financial worker gave me the phone number for the Minnesota Dental Line and Help. I talked to the Minnesota Dental Line and Help, and they mailed me the dental packet. Many of the dentists listed in the packet did not take new people. I did ask how often the dentist packet was updated. They said once a month. I then was moved over to a new social service agency and asked for help in finding a new dentist. It was put into my service agreement that they would help me in finding a dentist. The worker I got was having a hard time finding a dentist. The worker said the dentist list would not help. My worker's boss also had a hard time finding a dentist for me. Then I asked for help from my mental health worker, and it took her over 2 weeks to find someone. I started to see this dentist on February 14, 2006. The worker I have took me to the dentist and helped me with the paperwork at the dentist's office. I asked them when I should come back from another appointment. I am still waiting for that call. I know I will have to call them. Thank you for your time, and please write back or email me if you have any questions or comments.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, there is an existing dental advisory council within the Department of Human Services where we hope that this could live. And we have talked to the department about that, and they are supportive.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Tao. We recently heard another bill dealing with the same issue, and I know it is a big problem. But I also am aware that access to dentists is a big problem for people on MA generally. And I wonder if you know if there's, I know this study that you're proposing is just for people with disabilities, and I can appreciate that because I think it's a special problem. But I wonder if you know, if anybody's studying, well, I suppose probably the big reason there's general access problems is just simply low reimbursement rates. But is this being looked at more globally, or is it just people with disabilities?
Liebman and members, in my committee, there's a bill that is being introduced to increase access, and we're looking at this issue. I know that with the docs and the nurse, there's a practitioner in between that's able to do some of the stuff and bring the rate down a little bit. So we're looking, we're going that direction as well with the dentist industry. So that's something that we're looking at right now.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the governor's maybe I'm wrong on this, but I think he's got $10 million in his proposal for dental access for medical students.
Any further discussion, members? Seeing none, Representative Tao renews his motion that House Bill 707 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, member.
Representative, I think we're going to skip down. Representative Clark, is she? I saw her back there. Why don't we take Representative Clark's bill because she's here and not on the committee. So I will move House File 1623 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Well, I'm happy to bring a bill before you today that I hope will make you smile, because that's part of what the purpose of the bill is for. It's called the Bright Smiles Bill, and it basically, members, will extend a very successful dental pilot project that was started about 3 years ago, as I understand it, in St. Paul, to provide dental access to low-income and immigrant children. And our bill basically pays for that for the next 2 years, appropriates $173,500 from the general fund for that project. And then we also think that we ought to look at the Department of Health having a coordinator who will look throughout the state and try to see how we can create this kind of project as a broader opportunity for our young children who don't have access to dental care. It's basically serving low-income children. So I have three people who would like to testify today, Mr. Chairman. I think maybe we should get to them first. I'm not sure what your time.
That'd be great.
Okay. So Sharon Oswald, introduce yourself.
Ms. Oswald.
Thank you, Representative Karen Clark, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Sharon Oswald. I'm a manager, health manager with Greater Twin Cities United Way and the lead staff for the United Way Bright Smiles program, which is a focused response to the growing unmet dental care needs among our youngest children in the community. We know that dental decay is the most prevalent chronic childhood disease, and recently the CDC released a report showing a 15% increase in dental disease among our nation's youngest children ages 2 through 5 years. And these findings are consistent with our local experience, where over 40% of the children that we reached in 2006 in Ramsey County alone had immediate dental treatment needs. We also know that a healthy child requires a healthy mouth. And despite this, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services reports that dental care is the most unmet treatment need among children. It has untreated decay has the great potential to interrupt the overall healthy development of young children, and it often leads to costly restorative care. Children from low-income families, communities of color, and recent immigrant and refugee populations are significantly more likely to go without dental care and suffer from poor oral health. Due to cost, lack of insurance, transportation, language, and cultural differences. And despite the vast need that exists, our experience has shown us that there's an opportunity here for us to find a solution. We have interested and committed partners, and we know that these issues are nearly 100% preventable. Bright Smiles began as a pilot program in St. Paul, utilizing community health workers to reach out to families and educate parents about good dental hygiene practices and encouraging them to access the available dental care. And with the results of this pilot project, United Way convened stakeholders countywide, secured additional funding, developed 5 dental access care sites in underserved areas, and provided care for over 4,000 children ages 0 through 5. With additional funding, United Way would expand this program to Minneapolis and commit to fundraising to grow this program beyond the first 2 years. And why Minneapolis? We know that insured children are not accessing dental care in this area compared to children accessing care statewide. Only 26% of Minnesota healthcare program child participants ages 4 through 6 access dental services compared to 41% statewide. So by uniting a diverse group of interested partners, United Way will focus the energy, efforts, and expertise and have a long-term positive impact on this issue. And here with me today are two of our partners in Ramsey County to speak about their experiences and hopefully shed some light on the impact that it has on the families in our community.
Please identify yourself for the record, if you would. Thanks.
My name is Lois Burnt. In 1964, I began my career in dentistry as a dental hygienist working in community health care. For the next 32 years, I worked in private practice as both a dental hygienist and an office manager in a 1999 return to community health. Between these time periods, I saw great changes in the private sector, but sadly, still see many of the same problems that existed those many years ago still prevalent in the community dental health system. So I considered it a great privilege, and I consider it a great privilege, to work with United Way, the Knight Foundation, and PICO in an effort to change the way we approach children's dental health in Ramsey County, especially to our patient base on the west side. As dental clinics manager, I oversee the Bright Smiles program. Through the pilot program, we were able to provide dental health education for parents and dental screening for their children who just happened to be in our waiting room waiting to see a medical provider. Many of these children that were screened were referred to our dental clinics for their treatment, and unfortunately, a large number did not follow through. So in our final evaluation, we determined that we would better serve these children if we could provide treatment on-site and immediately when possible. In 2006, we established satellite clinics at both of our medical facilities. By utilizing the collaborative agreement, we are able to provide preventive care, including dental screening, prophylaxis, x-rays, fluoride treatment, sealants, and oral health instruction for children 0 to 5 and their older siblings. Last year, the Westside Bright Smiles program provided early intervention, dental health education, and referrals for about 1,000 children. This number greatly exceeds the access that we could have provided for them in our dental clinics. And we truly believe it is only through early intervention and education that we will make any significant, positive, and long-range impact on the oral health needs of our children. And one of the reasons for the success of our Bright Smiles program at Westside Community Health Services is due to the very hard work of our dental health educator, Sylvia Diaz.
Thanks, Lois. I'm Sylvia Diaz, and I'm the dental health educator, as Lois said. And I brought these pictures some of the pictures of our patients at Bright Smiles. Those pictures show the different stages of tooth decay. None of those patients are older than 5 years old. And actually, one of our patients, the youngest with tooth decay, was a 14-month-old. One of the what I learned through Bright Smiles is that As a dental health educator, I connected many families with dental care. Families that probably didn't have any hope to get their kids to the dentist for many reasons that were mentioned before. I have one of the stories about our first patient, our first hospital case. We just started in this program. The dental hygienist and I were trying to promote the program in the waiting room. And we saw this family, mom, who was pregnant at that time, dad, and the two daughters, 3 and 1 year old. They were eating candy at that time, and we were just offering our services. The mom was happily surprised because she told us that one of her daughters, the older one, had all her teeth rotten. That was the word that she used. And when we did, she didn't take care of that because she didn't know where to go. Some providers told her that at that age nobody will see her and some other problems. So we finally did the screening and her teeth were really looked like chocolate teeth. She had many cavities, and that's how another patient called all those children with extensive tooth decay. They looked like chocolate. And she had numerous abscesses in her mouth. All her 20 teeth have cavities. So we referred to one of our dental clinics, and the dentist took her to the hospital. And after that, he had to do all these treatments under general anesthesia. And this took 3 months. And after that, I mean, all the paperwork and everything. And after that, well, Reina, that's her name, was finally healthy. The thing here is we could find this patient, but there are so many others out there that don't have that luck. And fortunately, Reina's sister, she has another little sister, and they are healthy right now. They come every 6 months for their dental checkup. And when we ask mom how Bright Smile helped her, she said that Bright Smile helped her family not only to have access to dental care, they know now the importance of oral health overall health, and she knows now that her daughter had an infection that it was preventable, and now they have changed their oral habits, and also she now has a dental home. Like Reina, there are some others, like I said, and we really think that Bright Smiles can prevent and intervene at early age. Thank you for your time, and we are
thank you very much. That's fine. Representative Clark?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just want to say, you know, I think dental health is such a necessity. It affects so much these little children and certainly all people's, including adults' abilities to succeed in the world. And I think sometimes the issues of dental health take a back seat to other issues of health. And it's just very, very critical to really begin life with healthy teeth. And I think the money that would be saved in terms of trying to help healthy teeth at an early age is also really critical. And I don't know if we have a cost-benefit analysis to offer you, but I can... and we could work on that, but I would hope that you'd see just what a good investment this would be in the lives of these little children. And this is a pilot that would begin, if we get the full funding, I believe, in 3 neighborhoods in Minneapolis. And my hope would be that eventually all our children in Minnesota would have access to this kind of care. So the kind of partnerships that this is fostering, I think, are, again, a very good investment. A lot of the outreach, the community outreach workers that would be funded with this, for example, is key to making it successful and letting people know what the resources are.
Representative Lawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Clark, thanks for calling attention to a really huge unmet need, particularly amongst our uninsured and immigrant populations. You do have, under the application part, though, under 2.3, that this applicants are to be a partnership amongst, you know, early childhood, the Minneapolis schools, nonprofit clinics, et cetera. And I was hoping that as this evolves, you might want to try and facilitate, or at least in the language, facilitate the development of a single network within Minneapolis that would do that, because we have right now a children's dental health clinic that has long-term existed, I think almost over 20 years. It was originally in North Minneapolis. It's now in West Broadway. That's funded by both, I know, Hennepin County and Minneapolis. You have North Point in North Minneapolis, and the pushback I'm getting from some of our schools and some of these partners is that, you know, they can't belong to four different consortiums, even though we're a big city with 81 neighborhoods. Particularly our schools who are really stretched really want to see one network that's got kind of one way of dealing with referrals and collaboration and coordination. And so if you could keep that dialogue and working so that this pilot project fits in with current structures, and we create one structure together. Thank you.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I think it's an excellent idea. We could talk, maybe ask the people in St. Paul how they did it, but I would think that would be a goal we could put right into the legislation. It's very wise.
Right. Well, some of the clinics that you mentioned, North Point, Children's Dental Services, those are partners that we would look to work with. And so we would definitely try and integrate into the existing network.
Thank you. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Clark for bringing this bill forward and for the testifiers. As a provider, the first thing I do, actually, is look into somebody's mouth, even though I'm not a dentist, and because your dental health is obviously a good indicator of your overall health and well-being. So, and I frequently come across children who don't have good dental care, and the importance of education is critical. So thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Reverend Schumper?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify, does it include all family members? Because the bill says, and their families.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, when we were talking about this bill, I had the same question. I think the emphasis is on making sure that the little children get addressed, but I think one of the most important things we can do, and that the community health worker would be doing, would be to talk to the parents, help them understand some of these issues of dental health care, oral health. For one thing, they are the models to those children of a good oral health. So I think at least in terms of education and outreach, they would be critical. The parents would be critical. But I think right now, if I understand, in St. Paul, the emphasis is on a population, birth to five, that really kind of gets left out for the most part. So I don't know if you want to clarify that anymore.
That's correct. We're okay. Trying to reach families with children who are the youngest children. And we know that we can't deny care to their older siblings if a parent had to choose. So what we do is find families with youngest children and provide care for all the siblings and education to the parents.
Any further questions, members? Representative Clark, any?
No, I believe it's, will this be moved over to be included, possibly included in your?
It's going to go to.
Oh, it has to go to. Yes, right. You know, finance committee. It has to go to the next committee to be included.
Going to finance. That's right.
Thank
so,
well, I appreciate members' consideration.
Thank you very much. I will renew my motion that House File 1623 be recommended to pass and be referred to the finance committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Representative Rood will move House File 1074 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor, to the General Register. Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Good afternoon. I am proud to bring forward for your consideration House File 1074, the Darlene Luther Revised Uniform Anatomical Gift Act. Darlene was a member of the House of Representatives. I believe she came in with Representative Huntley. She passed away in 2002, and Darlene herself was a recipient of a liver transplant. The act is brought forward by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws and Life Source. This act was written to increase the number of lives saved through transplantation by providing uniformity in state laws, harmonizing law with current practice, and clarifying how individuals can document their wishes to donate along with who may make gifts for a person who has died. Here with us today to testify in support of this legislation is Susan Gunderson, Chief Executive Officer of LifeSource, and Bob Tennyson, Uniform Law Commissioner. Following Susan's testimony, you'll hear from Gene Janowski, whose son, teenage son, Alan, gave the gift of life through organ and tissue donation after his tragic and untimely death, and Ross Burgess, who's received a life-saving lung transplant after 9 years of battling with cystic fibrosis. And with that, I'm going to turn it over.
Ms. Hobbs.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and as Representative Root said, I'm one of the Uniform Law Commissioners from Minnesota. Let me just briefly explain what the Uniform Law Conference is. It's an organization of commissioners from each of the states and territories of the United States. It's about 120 years old. The purpose of it is to develop uniform laws for adoption by the states for a couple of reasons. One, to preserve the state's role in the federal system, but also, probably more importantly, to find or develop laws that are where there's need for uniformity across the states for ease of use and knowledge. For example, in this area, the transplant business is national, probably international, and we need to have common laws in the various states governing how the procedures work and so on. The conference works over a period of time to develop an act. This act took about 2 years to develop, and is really a modification or an updating of two previous acts in the area that we worked on. We're pretty thorough about that. We meet once we undertake a project. The committee is appointed about 9 commissioners. We then invite everybody who's involved in that area to come to the table and then participate. They sit around like you are right now with all of us and our commissioners and work through the agendas and come up with the drafts. For example, in participation, we reach out to all the various organizations and in this case, we have the American Bar Association, American Medical Association, American Lung Association, American Procurement Association, iBank of America, and lots of others at the table as we develop this. And we worked through this over 2.5 days on a weekend, arguing about the language, what works, what doesn't work. After a couple of years, usually a committee feels it has a product that brings us to the annual meeting, and it's read line by line, criticized by the whole body. Then go back, work another year, take the criticism, come back and refine the act. And that's basically what we do. And so the process is very vetted, and the language is worked over by all the interested parties so that hopefully it'll work. And our objective is to get these acts passed to ease the various objectives of whatever it is. In this case, it's organ transplant. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tess. Please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Susan Gunderson. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of LifeSource. LifeSource is a nonprofit organization based in St. Paul that coordinates organ and tissue donation for Minnesota and North and South Dakota and portions of Western Wisconsin. We are the sole organization that does this. We're here to provide our strong support for this bill that you're considering today related to organ and donation gifts. We think it will do wonderful things in helping us further the cause of donation in our communities. I want to highlight just a few of the key changes that you will find embedded in the long language and tell you a bit about why that's important in our communities. First, this act honors the decision and the choice of an individual when they make the decision to become an organ donor. It strengthens the language to prevent others from overturning their own choice. And importantly, this new UAGA reaffirms what we have embraced in Minnesota, where we recognize the individual's decision as their legal decision at the time of death. Secondly, the new Gift Act expands the list of those who can make gifts for another individual during that individual's lifetimes, so that healthcare agents, and in some cases parents or guardians, may also make those gifts. The new law provides guidance as to how gifts are made if there is more than one member in the class. For example, if there are multiple adult children and one of those children is opposed to donation, it now provides for the opportunity for the majority to make that decision on behalf of, in this case, the parents. It creates a default priority for transplantation over research or education.
recognizing the priority of organ transplantation as being the ultimate and highest priority. It encourages and provides for donor registries, places where individuals can register their decision to become an organ donor, which we now have in Minnesota and have had for several years. It also resolves the tension between a healthcare directive requesting the withholding or withdrawal of life support systems and making anatomical gifts by permitting measures to be sustained until the decision about donation can be assessed. Also, it clarifies and expands the rules relating to cooperation with and coordination between procurement agencies such as our own and medical examiner's offices and coroners, because they play a vital role as well in supporting and authorizing donation. As Mr. Tennyson mentioned, we're really pleased that this bill has been supported by so many national organizations, and I would say most importantly the American Medical Association and the American Bar Association have weighed in as leaders and supporters of this change. Minnesota has long been a leader in donation and transplantation, and we should be very proud of the way that our citizens serve our communities. Right now, we have 46% of Minnesotans who have designated themselves to be donors on their driver's license or identification card. That's ahead of the national rate of 40%. And of those who die and can actually become organ donors, nearly 70% of those individuals go on to make those gifts of donation, either through having made themselves identified as donors or their family members making the decision if they did not have a chance to make that themselves. This also compares very favorably to the national experience. That said, there is much more to do, and there are many, many thousands of patients awaiting a life-saving transplant. Every year, the gap between those who donate and those who need transplants grows, and this act will enable us to help try and shorten that gap, offering the gift of life to more individuals. We are very privileged here. For a number of years, we've been partnering with the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services under the leadership of Pat McCormick and with the strong support of Commissioner Mike Campion. The state also provides us information about an individual's donor designation status at the time of death to ensure that we are in the position to honor and fulfill their wishes, as provided in the current Darlene Luther Anatomical Gift Act adopted in 2001. We are particularly honored to have Darlene Luther's legacy continue through the renaming of this act in her memory. She was a tireless advocate for donation. The state also ensures that information about donation is available at all the driver's license bureaus. These flyers, which I hope you will have distributed or have already had distributed, are the ones that are available in all the bureaus across the state. They feature the story of a young girl named Alexa, whose picture is on here, and she was waiting for a lung transplant at the University of Minnesota. Sadly, she passed away at the age of 14 because an organ did not become available for her in time. And her parents, who live in West Fargo, have made this a personal mission that no other child should pass away simply because there have not been enough organs available for transplantation. This flyer is available, as I said, at all the bureaus, and it also references the website, which is now an online registry where individuals can indicate their donation wishes in addition to providing them on the driver's license. It is our hope that Minnesota will continue to be a leader in this area of healthcare, as in so many other areas, because we do have thousands of patients who are on both sides of this equation, both as individuals who can donate and as individuals who are touched by that gift of life. In just a minute, you'll have a chance to hear both of those perspectives. But on behalf of the others who are waiting, I would encourage you to support this legislation, as we believe it will really move us forward in advancing donation in Minnesota. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Jean Jenna Hosky, and I am donor mom to my son, Alan. Alan is forever 17 years, 1 month, and 4 days old. As a young boy, Alan was always gentle, caring, and considerate, always extending his love to family and friends. This wonderful quality followed him the rest of his life. He was a diligent boy, overcoming delayed speech and a reading disability. He loved his computer. At age 13, 14, and 15, he attended summer camp, computer camp at Moorhead State. He enrolled in advanced computer classes in school. He became a computer technician in his dad's office and two neighboring businesses. At age 16, his entrepreneurial spirit subscribed to industry magazines, which came to the house addressed to his business name of Janotech. One evening while I was preparing dinner, Alan came home from school. He had just attended driver's ed. He spread his papers out on the table and he said, "Mom, do you think I should be an organ donor?" I was shocked and I was unprepared because certainly I had never thought of anything happening to any member of our family, let alone my children. But Alan persisted and he said, "Mom, if something happens to me and I don't need my organs and they could help someone else, why not?" So Alan proceeded and checked yes on his driver's license. 1 year later, Alan was visiting family friends in Alabama. After an exciting day of activities, 5 minutes from their home destination, a tragic auto accident occurred, sending Alan helicopter-bound to a trauma center in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Our family, entering our own twilight zone, chartered an airplane and flew immediately from Minneapolis to Chattanooga. There we found Alan, critical with a head injury. His father and I sat by his side. It became clear that Alan's life was to be no more. Brokenhearted, we desperately searched for guidance to somehow extend his time with us. But Alan had already given us that answer. That evening discussion when I was making dinner. Our son became a true hero the next day when he donated the gift of his heart to a man in the computer industry. His kidneys, pancreas, liver, and small intestine went to other people in need of the gift of life. His cornea went to a woman suffering from blindness. Alan's love lives forever in our hearts, and his circle of life continues with those he saved. In 2002, here in Minneapolis, at the U.S. Transplant Games, my family had the wonderful opportunity of meeting Jimmy from Mississippi, Alan's kidney pancreas recipient. We also met his mother and his sister, who was also a kidney pancreas recipient. Our families joined together for 3 days. At the end of that time, our families merged as one. I haven't received communication from other recipients of Alan's, but that's okay because Alan and we as parents gave the gift of life, not expecting anything in return. I am grateful for the continued life of every recipient. I am so proud to say that Alan's legacy lives through the gift of life. His donation was and still is critical to my family's healing. It gave us strength to endure the yesterdays, courage and hope for the todays and all the tomorrows. Every member of my family aspires to someday making organ donation our family legacy. I'd like to quote to you, Alan loved country music, and I really didn't realize this till later, but there's a little stanza in the Travis Tritt, I think it's called Three Crosses, and it says, "It's not what you take with you when you leave this world behind, it's what you leave behind you when you go." Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Ross Bourgeois, and I was fortunate enough to receive a double lung transplant on April 4th, 2005. The reason I needed a lung transplant is I was born with cystic fibrosis, which is a disease that affects your lungs, your pancreas, and your digestive system. It's a degenerative disease, so it gets worse as you get older. It causes your body to produce mucus that's too thick and sticky, so it's hard to get out of your lungs. So it's a perfect breeding ground for bacteria. So people with CF have chronic lung infections. It's kind of like having a cold all the time, a real bad cold all the time. So you're congested, you're coughing all the time. Just to keep your lungs clear enough to function every day, people with CF have to endure many hours of bronchial drainage treatments, which kind of shake your body to help loosen up the mucus so you can cough it out. I was doing 4 treatments a day, and each treatment would take about an hour, so 4 hours a day was just doing that treatment. Many inhalers, many nebulizers, just to try to keep your lungs clear. In 2003, my lung function had dropped to the point where I only had 20% lung function, and my doctor decided it was time to be put on the lung transplant list. In January of 2004, I got so sick that I had to stop working. I was a high school math teacher at Minneapolis Henry High School, and I was put on oxygen for the first time. As the year went on, I steadily got worse. My lungs got worse and worse. Little daily chores became more and more difficult to do. I have only 13 steps in my house, but it would take me about 20 minutes to get up the steps. Things like showering would take about 20, 30 minutes. Getting dressed in the morning would take about 20 minutes. Every little thing just took a lot of work, a lot of effort, and none of the antibiotics seemed to be working at the time. Having CF, you're on antibiotics your whole life, so your body starts to build up a resistance to them. So after a while, they don't work anymore. On March 30th of 2005, I got so sick, I was in the hospital, and my lungs finally gave out, and I had to be put on a ventilator. Several days later, after the doctors have tried everything they could to clear out my lungs, nothing seemed to be working, they finally just told my family that we were just going to have to make me comfortable. If I didn't get a transplant within a day or so, I only had about a 10% chance of surviving the next couple days. So on Saturday, the day right after they told my family that, my family and friends all came up and said their goodbyes. A priest came in and gave me my last rites. And the next day, my wife always says it was during Desperate Housewives, so that's why she remembers the time, they came in and said they had a new pair of lungs for me. So it came just in time. Because I was so sick and the surgery was very difficult, because of previous surgeries I had, it took about 10 hours for the surgery. My recovery was very difficult and long. I was in the hospital for 4 months. I was on a ventilator for about 2.5 more months. And because I was in bed for so long, I had to relearn how to walk all over again. So it was a long journey. But since the transplant, I've been able to celebrate my 5th and 6th wedding anniversary. I celebrated my 42nd birthday. I was able to golf this summer for the first time in about 3 years. I used to love to golf. I went fishing this summer for the first time in about 10 years. And I'm back in the classroom this year as a volunteer, and I'm hoping that someday I'll be able to go back and teach. Keep my fingers crossed for that. I also, this summer, I had the very, very fortunate opportunity to meet my donor family. My donor's name was Brady from a small town in northern Minnesota. Was killed by a drunk driver. He was only 18 years old. I met his mother and his sister and the mom's husband. I talk to the mom almost every month, and it's just been great. Brady wasn't a donor. He didn't have it on his driver's license. She was the one that decided to donate. She said it hit her like a lightning bolt. While she was back in Manoman getting a change of clothes, he was down here at Hennepin County Medical Center, and she said it just hit her like a lightning bolt that she had to donate his organs. So she came down and asked to talk to LifeSource about donating, and he was able to save 5 lives with his donation. So one of the slogans that LifeSource has is, when you're an organ donor, you're giving the gift of life, and that's really what you're doing, and I'm a perfect example of that. I would not be here today if it wasn't for her decision to do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, any questions on the for the testifiers or for Representative Rood on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I do, and it's probably for Representative Rood to start with, but I'm sure she's probably going to have some of the folks that have been involved with putting this together. It's not for the testifiers. First, for Representative Rood, I wish I would have been a little bit quicker on this one. I think I must have been too focused on the cannabis that we're going to be talking about, but the it's interesting to me that we're repealing. But we've heard testimony today about success stories. Lots of sadness, but out of sadness apparently comes some good things. And yet it appears that you are going to replace a law that looks to me like it's on the books since the late 60s, early 70s, and seems to be working rather well. It looks like the two significant changes are, rather than allowing one person to make the decision, it will now be a majority. Is that correct?
I'm going to look to my testifiers to comment on that.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chair, committee member, the individual themselves is the person who can first make the decision. And absent a decision by that person in life, there is a priority next of kin that is are charged with the responsibility to make a decision. It has always been one. It is still one. If there are multiple members in a class at the same level, multiple siblings, now there's clarification that a majority of that class are empowered to make the decision.
Mr. Chairman. And for the testifier, why is that necessary?
Mr. Chair, committee member, I believe that the clarifications about who makes the decision is to help resolve some of the ambiguity in situations where it was unclear what is the priority should be in terms of the decision makers.
Mr. Chair,
okay, member.
The problem I'm having, Representative Rood, is I'm hearing about some ambiguity, which I don't think any of the testimony has brought out that there's ambiguity. It's not as if we're trying to change just one provision of the existing act. It has basically been completely rewritten, and I'll give you something that really troubles me. When we rewrite something like this, and now we add on page 1, starting at line 1.23, in the definition of decedent, the term includes a stillborn infant and, subject to restrictions imposed by other law, a fetus. I don't understand why we're changing this law, and I think this is a way too... this is excessive for what we're... I see somebody shaking their head. Maybe Mr. Tennyson's going to tell me that's in law right now.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that is the case right now. It's his current law.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Tennyson, can you cite me in the current statute? Because I didn't see it. If it's there, I apologize.
I don't have a current.
This is a side-by-side comparison of right here, Subversion 3, the student.
The current definition says... decedent is a he's a deceased individual, and an individual includes a stillborn infant or an embryo or a fetus that has died of natural causes in utero.
Mr. Chairman.
Whatever.
Well, that is a significant change, Mr. Tennyson. In utero is a little bit more definitive than what we're doing here.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr.
Tennyson, I was calling my colleague back Davies here, who was the advisor to the committee. I was not on the committee, but I think that...
Mr. Tennyson, Representative Rood, I think what we're going to do is allow... we're going to lay this bill over momentarily, and maybe Representative Emmer can... Maybe you can talk through some of your questions, and we can at least get the citations down with them, and then we can come back and do that.
Yep.
So we're going to lay House File 1074 over for now.
Yeah.
And Representative Huntley. Yes. Representative Huntley, we're going to take House File 655 back up off the table. And it was previously amended with the A1 amendment last time, members. I know there's some amendments. Okay, now they both have all gone. Representative Huntley, there's an amendment, an A5 amendment, page 10, deleting page 10, line 25. I understand, Representative Huntley, that that's a friendly amendment that you'd be willing to accept.
That's fine.
Is that accepted? Okay. Representative Huntley would We'll move the A5 amendments. All those in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
Oh, it's coming around.
Oh.
It deletes, it's page 10, it deletes line 25. It's,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It relates to notice of before the inspection, and so what it says is they do not have to give notice before there's an inspection of the facility.
Members have that? Okay. All in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
All right. All those opposed? That amendment is adopted. Representative Putley, there's an A4 amendment, page 4. It deletes subdivision 9 on page 4, members. Have you looked at that amendment? It has to do with reciprocity?
Yes.
Are you comfortable with that amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's okay.
All right. Representative Huntley will move the A4 amendments. Do members understand what the amendment is? Okay, all in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
All right, all opposed? That amendment is adopted. There is an A3 amendment. Members, if we could get that one passed around. It's on page 5, line 16. And it actually sets the application and renewal fee, which is blank right now, at a specific amount, which is $750. Have you reviewed? Has that amendment been reviewed?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's a bit...
You okay with that?
Well, it's a bit high, but...
Listen and watch.
I guess I can live with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley. You know, I do think there should be an amount, but I agree with you that the number is quite high. I'd be okay with voting to get it on, and maybe we can figure out a sliding fee language going to the next committee. But it is quite high for individuals that usually have lower income once they get into the state that we're talking about.
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, you know, again, most of these people that are going to get these scripts are people that are either terminal or in most cases can't work because of the pain level.
And Representative Hull, I don't think this is your amendment, so why don't we just set the A, we'll lay the A3 on this table for now. I don't think, does anybody in the room have that amendment? No. Okay. And who is the author of the amendment, is what I mean. I don't think it's anybody who's in the room. Okay. Representative Huntley, have you reviewed the A2 amendment, which says a registered organization must pay a fee of $500 per plant?
Again, Mr. Chairman, I think that's way too high.
Okay. How about the A7 amendment? Do you guys have the A3 or the A2 amendments? Are those one of yours?
Sure we do.
We've adopted the A4 and A5 already, so they're on the bill.
You got that, Sonny? Okay.
No, that
didn't. Mr. Chairman, I would move the A3 amendment.
Okay. Representative Emmer moves the A3 amendment.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, the A3 amendment simply goes to the fee that would be charged for a card. Right now, the Act, and I believe Mr. Lehman pointed it out to me earlier today, the Act allows the commissioner to set the fee. I prefer to put an actual fee in the bill, and I've got another one to charge another fee, which would be a different amendment, so I don't have to repeat it. I think Mr. Lehman can confirm it if he wants to, but it was Oregon, I think, has fees that they have put with their program and have, in fact, have generated substantial revenues to the state. So A3, that's the basis for it, and I'd ask for your support.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, is Oregon fee amount $750?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the question, Representative Walker. That I do not know. I will tell you how I based mine. when looking yesterday, or when processing the testimony that we received and the fact that someone somewhere has put a street value at $200 per ounce, which is rather significant, and then hearing the testimony that one plant can produce, I think it was 30 pounds or something, or 70 cigarettes, I actually went through and tried to figure out how much you might generate off of 12 plants, and then came up with this. And I'm sorry, but I left my homework up in my office. But that's where I got the $750, and then the next one that you'll hear, the other amendment. And the answer to your question is no. I don't know if it's Oregon.
Well, can I just clarify one thing with the witness? I think there's some confusion about how much these plants can.
Mr. Chair, I believe the fee in Oregon was $100 to enter the program, and the surplus was over $1 million that they took out of the program to go to a general fund to help with the budget crisis that most states were facing a few years ago. The fees, almost all these programs are self-sustaining. The fees usually are on $100, and most of the programs, the fees have actually been cut. The original fee in Montana was $100. I believe they've cut it down, so... Just as a point of information.
I appreciate that. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that also. Representative Emmer, what I had said while you were out of the room was I personally don't have a problem with the fee. I do think $750 is excessive, especially when you're dealing with individuals that at this stage that would be utilizing this don't have a lot of money. And, you know, I think to about the constituents that I hear from that have difficulties paying the lump sums for property taxes, for example, to come up with $750 is excessive for individuals. You know, what do you give up that month? Do you decide not to pay rent for 1 month of, you know, to make sure you have your next year's renewal? And so I actually will move an oral amendment to Representative Emmer's amendment. On line 1-2, I move to insert $100 in place of $750.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you. And Representative Walker, I truly do appreciate your perspective, but I think that perhaps you're reading the bill rather narrowly. You're reading it from the standpoint of just a small group of people that this might apply to. In fact, if you read the bill when it talks about chronic pain, this would apply to Randy Moss. And I would throw out to you that Randy Moss can afford the $100 or the $750. And what I was trying to do is strike a balance. Now, if we have people who this is going to be applying to chronic pain, I understand and I respect the perspective that you have from it. But I think this goes way beyond that, and therefore I would oppose it. At this point.
Mr. Chair, real quick. Just
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, the other piece that I didn't say that I said while you were out of the room was I don't have a problem putting placeholder language in trying to figure out a sliding fee. And so I renew my hope in members of supporting my oral amendment to this amendment at $100.
Mr. Chair, at this point, sliding fee is what I'm trying to stay away from because we've got the we're leaving it up to the commissioner. In order to move this forward in the spirit of compromise, I'll support that.
Will you just incorporate it?
I'll incorporate it. Thank you.
All right,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huntley.
If I could just respond to one. We've already adopted the A7 amendment, which would not allow Mr. Moss to participate in this program.
Okay. We'll get to that one. It's just the bill. Okay. Represent any further discussion on this A3 amendment? If seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. A2. Representative Emmer.
A2 to 500.
I think. This is the 500, the commissioner fee you're talking about.
The A2, I would move the A2 amendment. The A2 is 500 per plant. And again, that's based on if we've got a $200 an ounce street value, I think 500 is rather light. I'd ask for your support.
Representative Huntley or anybody, any further discussion? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Emmer, under your amendment here now, is this, if I have a plant and I acquire it, I pay $500. If I then cultivate it, do I pay another $500, and if I then deliver it, do I pay another $500 all for the same plant?
Representative Emmer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I guess the intent, and you're pointing out a major problem with the proposed legislation, because I certainly hope we're not going to be cultivating it, transporting it, delivering it, getting in the business of the crop of marijuana. My amendment, and if it's improperly drafted, I'm open to suggestions, was simply to put a value of $500 on one plant, or each plant.
Yeah. Okay. President Hamilton? Is that...
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, and if this isn't the appropriate time, just let me know and I'll ask the question again. But we're talking about the plants, and I'm going to just use myself as an example, walk through a hypothetical here. I have multiple sclerosis, so I would qualify, potentially. And if I went to the doctor and got my card, et cetera, I'd be able to qualify. How do I get started? You know, we're talking about that first plant. Where do I get it? How do I get started?
Why don't we take that question narrowly here, because that's good. Fair, and answer if to testify.
Mr. Chair, you're asking where you find the first, where you would get the first seed?
Mm-hmm.
That is the issue that every state has, because there is the federal conflict. What the purpose of these laws, why these 11 states have passed these laws, is because there is this roadblock on the federal level, so states have felt compelled, either through the electorate or through their legislatures, to protect their citizens from the threat of arrest, trying to alleviate the pain. And the reason these laws are so effective is because 99% of all marijuana arrests are made at the state and local level. So if you're asking what is the legal way for the first seed to be procured, the answer is that there is no answer to that because of the federal law. So, but the reality is that a lot of patients currently are using marijuana and they're using it illegally, and this would protect them from the threat of arrest. So in all these 11 states, that's undefined. In every single one of these states, where the law is up and functional and working.
Mr. Chairman, I have follow-up questions. Should I do it now or later?
You know,
the same issue.
Hamilton, I think this amendment is going to the registered organization. I suppose, you know, so it wouldn't be you individually acquiring it with regard to this amendment. Why don't we hold off with the questions until we get to the bill?
Fair enough.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I just want to point out, and maybe I should have done this originally, this is just for the registered organizations. This isn't for the people. If you read it, I mean, the intent was these, whatever they are, nonprofits or the organizations that will have the plants will have that value and they'll have to pay it.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, that would then require that they would charge at least $500 to each patient for each plant that the patient received from them. And again, I think the burden on many of these people is going to be their low income, not capable of working. How are they going to afford that?
Resident Walker. Do you want to go? Or? Okay. Any further questions to the amendment? Okay. Representative Emmer moves the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. The amendment is not adopted. The A7 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, that's my amendment.
Representative Anderson, your amendment.
Mr. Chairman, some people are concerned about this being putting severe or chronic in the bill on page 2, and so... To make it a little bit more acceptable, we added this language in there, and I think Mr. Lehman could speak to it more profoundly.
Representative Huntley?
I thought we already adopted it. I guess we didn't, and I agree with this amendment, and I strongly support it.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the A7 amendment, all in favor, members, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted. And my favorite amendment of all, and I got to give, this is good legislating. So, Representative Emery, I don't know. The Sixth Amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should all be offended by that.
Yeah, I showed everybody except Representative Member. I'm sorry. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I please have another?
That was meant sincerely.
The other one.
I would move the A6 Amendment.
All right, to your amendment, Representative.
Yes, and I appreciate the levity. I hope it's taken in the right vein. I'm not a fan of this legislation, and I'm offering this amendment in the spirit with which I receive the legislation. And I, again, don't want to offend anybody, because I think if we're going to treat something as medicine, then it should be handled like medicine, and I don't think this bill does that. This amendment simply would allow an employer and a church that do not fall within the definition of a public place to prohibit the possession and use of marijuana on the premises.
Representative Tom.
Representative Emmer, can they just put the word marijuana next to the word gun?
Mr. Chairman, if Representative Tao would like me to include brownies in the amendment, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Representative Shumper.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I have to say I'm a bit confused in all seriousness about the discussion on this bill. This bill got a lot of publicity, not so much because of the author as the co-author of this bill, your colleague, Representative and former Speaker Steve Spigum. And it's really hard. I think that I have some questions about the whole legal framework of this bill vis-a-vis the federal government's stand on marijuana. It doesn't seem like we're going to get that sorted out today, but, this is a pretty tight bill from my reading it, and I spent a lot of time reading it. It's a pretty tight bill. It certainly strikes me as being tighter than any of the other state bills in the other 11 states. So, I'm not sure in what spirit you're making this amendment, but I did want to say that to you.
Mr. Chair, all I would respond to Representative Chumper is that I do I respect everybody's perspective. I just don't have to agree with it, and I would suggest that to you, I'm not confused by the bill. I don't see it as being tight enough at all. Why would we have, let's say, Vicodin were grown in a plant? Why would we allow people to possess 12 Vicodin plants in their home and then not have any ability to control where those go? Seems to me that on a political, philosophical discussion, you either make it all legal or you treat it all the same. If this is like Vicodin, if this is truly a pain killing drug, then let's handle it that way, and let's make sure that we have the appropriate restrictions that we have for every other painkiller out there that's a prescribed over-the-counter medication. I disagree with you that it's that tight, and I think we've got examples in other states. Granted, it's not letter for letter like other states, but it has some of the same problems. So I think you and I just have a difference of opinion.
Further discussion, members? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Emmer, looking at this and taking it, giving it the benefit of a doubt as a serious amendment, I have to ask you, is it your intent here to allow employers and churches, and I assume you mean synagogues and mosques and other places of worship as well, is it your intention to allow them to prohibit the medical use of marijuana on their premises or to force them to put up all these signs? Because if I may just continue for a second, Mr. Chair, you could certainly have an amendment that would make it clear that places have the right to ban it without going to all of this thing about the sign.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative.
I don't know that you want me to go there.
I know. Let's. Okay. Representative Tao. Thank you. President Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't oppose this amendment, but it's really not needed since the bill already prevents the use of smoking marijuana in any public place.
No. Okay, let's vote. To the A6 amendment. All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Yeah.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
No. Amendment is not adopted. That's all the amendments I have, members. Okay. To the bill.
Again, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hamilton, you're right, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And following up on that, like two testifiers, Representative Huntley, I was wondering once again, hypothetically speaking, and myself as an individual, if the doctor says it's okay, security guard, et cetera, et cetera. My first question was, how do I get started? And as far as the answer is, it's pretty much up to me who I address to get that first plant. Is that correct?
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, the first thing you would do is you would have to go to a physician and get a prescription. Once you got that, actually it's not called a prescription, it's a recommendation. Mm-hmm. And once you got that, you would take that recommendation to one of these organizations that has these plants. They would then give you the plants that you are entitled to by the prescription, and you would get a plant, and then you could take it home, or a several plants, actually 10, isn't it? Yeah.
Mr. Chair. So how do you, if you were going to an organization, they actually wouldn't give you the plant. They would just give you the marijuana, and the plants would stay with the organization. And they could only have as many plants up to the maximum allowed per patient. And they can only have enough those plants per patient that are registered to the organization. The first seed argument, it's something that is confounding and troubling, I would say, on some levels, rightfully so, to a lot of legislators who are thinking about this in a thorough and pragmatic way. Because of the federal conflict, which does exist, there is no clean legal answer to that. But what we do know is that these patients do get seeds, and they do grow plants, and they do have marijuana, and they are protected from arrest by state and local authorities. And that's the point, is that because of, we heard a lot of testimony yesterday from Mr. Backstrom, and he was talking about the FDA, and there actually is a few things I would like to say about that, but the FDA did make this statement that he quoted about a year and a half ago, which was widely panned in well over 20, 30 editorials, op-ed pages, and the medical establishment as a political, not scientific move. There is the reason you have this unique situation where 11 states have passed this law is because there is this conflict and there is this need, and there are the citizens of these states who are suffering and are risking the threat of arrest. As we heard Mr. Pakkinen testify yesterday, his son was harassed because he came before the legislature. And so this is just designed to protect those people from the threat of arrest. And so when they're dealing with their symptoms and they're dealing with their pain or their illness, they don't have to think about the violation of law, and they shouldn't have to be made into criminals for simply trying to alleviate their pain. So that's the thrust of these bills, and I'd love to give you a clean answer of how you get to proceed, but the reality is there are lots of Minnesotans right now who are using marijuana illegally to alleviate the symptoms of their, whatever illness that they have, and it's designed to protect them, and there is no clean way to get to proceed.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hamilton.
So once I take it upon myself and I find that first seed and I grow those plants and I have a number of plants within my home, because again, I've done all the steps, I went to my doctor, I have multiple sclerosis, he gave me the certificate, the card, the recommendation, whatever, I did all that part, I have those plants in my possession in my home. Once those plants do bud, I harvest those seeds, can I sell those to other MS patients?
No.
I cannot.
No, Mr.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
So how do I dispose of those seeds then? What's the proper method?
Mr. Lee? Of unused marijuana seeds?
Once you're done using the seeds.
Well, the plant will probably continue to grow, and
right.
Don't they bud? And they have people know
better
every year.
Well, marijuana works than I do, but
yeah?
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, so just being in agriculture, you know, this plant will... this plant will grow, and I'm trying to be serious.
Good line of questioning.
That's fair, very fair. Okay. Thanks for your apology, Representative Emmer. I appreciate it. So the plant will grow. It will bud out. It'll seed. You'll have those seeds. So I'm saying, as an individual, you know, that legally now I can possess that. I can have it in my possession. And so now a friend of mine that has multiple sclerosis also comes up to me and says, Representative Hamilton, I have no way of getting that first plant. Can you help me? Now I give that person that seed.
You cannot, under the law.
Okay, so now I'm a criminal helping out. So basically, under the current law, I've potentially done two violations. Number one, I went out and purchased the seed from my local drug dealer and to get myself started. Number two, they have budded out. I've harvested them to do my friend who has multiple sclerosis also a favor. And now all of a sudden, I'm a criminal once again. Is that it? That's right. Is it not?
Ms. Levine?
Under the current law, you would not be allowed to pass a marijuana seed on to another patient, qualified or otherwise. That's part of the provision of that we're trying to make this a tight law. So again, as long as there is the federal conflict, which we acknowledge, there is no perfect answer to that. But again, the reality is that there are a lot of people who are using it now, and this is just designed to protect them.
So, Mr. Chairman, I mean, this is my point exactly, and this is why I'm having problems with this whole thing. So I'll just end. I have more statements, but I'll end it right there.
And it's best as a registered organization, I suppose.
But, Mr. Chair, if I just may say, I would actually share that concern that you're voicing, but because of the current situation, I would think it would be an imperfect solution to charge patients with the ability to distribute marijuana, and that's not a situation I think we'd want to get into.
But we are. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I can honestly say that the proponents of the bill, I think, have moved miles. And so I really do appreciate some of the things that you did change. The reciprocity, I think, was of great concern. There's a number of other things. But while you try to move this bill and to make it as tight as possible, which is an approach I also appreciate, I still do think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, that there's some significant holes in the bill. And let me just point out one of them that I have concerns about. I've spoken with Mr. Lehman about it a little bit and hope that maybe we can work on it. You know, even in Minnesota, we even require people to sign when they buy Sudafed at a pharmacy or whatever, but we're not asking for any signatures, we're not asking for any cross-checking, cross-referencing. They pay $10, they get the card, but there's nothing after that. And so it seems like there's some lack of oversight after that point. The other thing is on page 7. It talks about losing the card. And there's no limit on the number of reissues of cards. I guess I have some concern that a lost card, I'm not sure what form this card is taking. Is it a photo ID? Is it just a name? What is the format of the card? I'm a little concerned that there's no limits on that as well. And so, you know, me sometimes being a rather forgetful person, I suppose I could lose my card and go get another one. I'm just wondering if we could maybe work on tightening things in that direction. I think there's some things that still need to be tightened. But again, I want to thank you for the movements that you have made.
Mr. Chair, this will have to go to several other committees, and I would agree that if maybe we need better definition of what the identification card is and how many times you can lose it, I would not be opposed to modifying that part of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Pelley. Further discussion, President Norton.
Thank you, Chair Tacey. We've had a lot of discussion about this, and I'm just needing to clarify it. You cannot grow your own without being a nonprofit. I'm not sure what the organization, an allowed organization. And the example that was given earlier that somehow you do grow your own and you then apply to be an organization, I think, as the chair suggested, and then you're registered, it's still, there still is a clause in there that says even a person that is a registered distributor cannot give it to anybody else. I believe they couldn't pass on that seed even as I'm reading this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, the bill allows for several ways for the patients to have marijuana. One is the patient can grow it for themselves. Number two...
Yes, but they can't get the seed.
Right. They... Again, that's nothing that the state of Minnesota can address with its laws.
Well, but you're asking me to approve it, so I just say legally they cannot do that, but it's written in here that
No. In all of the 11 states, every single state has a grow-your-own provision, and in every single state, not every single state, I believe 10 of the 11 have grow-your-own provisions, and in those states, the patients are growing marijuana. They are getting seeds. For the most part, a lot of these people were already using marijuana completely legally, and what this does is protect them for having a safe supply of the medicine. But under the Minnesota bill, so you could you could grow it yourself. B, if you are physically unable or you don't have a green thumb or what have you, you can have a designated caregiver who could prepare the marijuana for you. Or if you cannot find somebody or you prefer to go to one of these nonprofit organizations, then you could designate them as the person who would have your marijuana. So those are three ways to obtain it. But again, and with all due respect, I cannot give an answer to how to get the first seed because the state of Minnesota has no power to address that.
And if I could just ask my second part to this, it has to do with the length of the prescription. Are we assuming, and I looked over this the other day and I've been frankly trying to find it again and I can't, so perhaps you can just answer for me. The length of prescription is how long?
Once a patient has been recommended by their doctor and they fill out all the appropriate paperwork and approved by the state of Minnesota, their card would be good for 1 year. And then they would have to reapply.
And if they cannot get a renewal of that prescription, who is going to be responsible to go into the home and reclaim the plants? We did talk about the other day when we were discussing this how that would be handled with the nonprofit, but is there something in place to reclaim the seeds, the plants, in the person whose prescription has not been renewed?
I believe that in the bill currently there is not. The same as that, for example, that there's no way for someone to go back into a home and get morphine or something like that for somebody whose prescription has run out.
But there is a difference with that because that's a number of pills that even if you've lost your prescription, there's still a finite number of pills. With a plant, it is never ending, as we talked about earlier.
Correct. And to be clear, if they were not registered at that point, they would no longer be protected under the law. So, for example, there are lots of people who are growing marijuana illegally in the state right now, and if that person at that point would be growing marijuana illegally.
And that was my point. I was just asking if there was a provision then to recapture, or is someone going to turn them in, or was there anything in here to see that the law...
There is nothing along those lines, but they would not be protected under the law.
Thank you.
Representative Hamilton,
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, through the bill, you know, most of my decision, political positions and whatnot, are based on real life experiences. And I appreciate all the testimony and the testifiers because they were coming up here with genuine concerns, talking about their conditions and everything else. And like I said, I can relate. I do have multiple sclerosis, and I can relate, you know, with the muscle spasms, the pain, et cetera, et cetera. I understand that, but I also have two children. And we have, you know, we sit down, we're very open and honest with our children, and I talk to my kids about this too. My oldest son is 15 years old, you know, and he has always said, you know, you always talk to us about the dangers of drugs, et cetera, you know, marijuana being one of those. Absolutely, we've done that all along. And he did say, he could comprehend. He said, Dad, if there's something out there that's going to help you, I can understand that. My daughter's 12 years old, And of course, she's a heckler and everything else. And she says, "Oh, Dad, my whole life has been a lie. You know, his whole life has been a lie. You know, teaching me the dangers of drugs." And after she was done heckling with me, you know, we were talking about this. She couldn't comprehend. And when my son said, "You know, if this would benefit Dad, you know, that'd be fine," and she fired back and said, "Well, you're saying it's okay for Dad to be a pothead, and you know, whatever." She couldn't comprehend. And you know, so. Again, when I take a look at this, I'm a parent first, and I'm an MS patient second. And so today, you know, I'm going to have to side with my children, right, wrong, or otherwise, and I'm going to vote no on this bill, and I'm going to ask my friends and colleagues to do the same.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. Representative Holly?
If I could respond a little bit to that. Could there be some abuse of this program? Yes, there probably could be some, but I think the abuse would be minimal, and the aim is to try to help people with chronic pain. And if you look at what happens with most people, if they're in a hospital intensive care unit and they're hooked up to a morphine drip, they push the button when they figure they need morphine, and almost none of them OD. Okay, they're all very careful. They know how much they need, and they know when to push that button, and they know when to not push that button. And it's my feeling that most of the people that would be affected by this bill would be very careful about how they use it. They're not going to be taking huge amounts and then going out and driving cars. They're just trying to deal with their pain, and they know when they don't feel the pain anymore.
Representative Anderson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley, our testifiers. I have two married children and hopefully someday grandchildren, and I'm sure that maybe some of them at the table here have grandchildren already. But if I meet the qualifications as a patient and meet the whatever is required here for me to use marijuana, and for whatever reason my grandchild at a date unknown decides to use this, does he become now a criminal because he's taken some of my medical use of marijuana?
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that your son or grandson would have done something illegal and would be subject to the usual penalties of law for that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, what will the penalties be?
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the existing penalty for use of marijuana under state statute, which I believe for some offenses is a $600 fine under the current statutes.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, because it's through no fault of my own, I end up paying that, or does the state get to pay it?
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
I think it's a $300 fine now.
I think it's going to public safety as well.
Yeah, I think it would be the same as if the grandchild or child got into your medicine cabinet and took an oxycodone, which would also not be legal, even though the patient's allowed to have it.
Yeah. Any further discussion, members? All right, seeing none. Representative Huntley renews his motion that House File 655 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public... Public Safety? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Division.
All right. Division. All those in favor, raise your hands, please. Are you... Okay, and I'll just pose race. Keep your hand. Six? Okay. 6, is that right? There being 8 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hotley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Emmer and Rod, have you guys...
No.
Mr. Chairman, there's still some concern over some of the language, and with your permission, I don't know if you can hold this bill, or we'd like to discuss it a little bit more. There's a lot to it.
You know, and this is going to be Representative Lothar.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, while we decide this, if the group, whether we work on it here or work after, I'd like to hear whether or not this interferes with our ability to get interstate donations, because part of the premise of this was uniformity across states, and I know people have gotten organs from other states.
Oh. You know, why don't you guys take a minute here to talk a little bit more about it, see if there's something we can do, because I forgot, Mr. Prokopowicz, please come up to the, and has a statement, I think. It's not really testimony on the bill per se, but a statement in response to some comments that were made yesterday.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Prokopowicz. I'm the Chief Deputy Dakota County Attorney, and Mr. Backstrom has asked me to come forward to clarify some of the comments that were made, as well as some follow-up comments that were made. I do have a handout that he has prepared that would like to have distributed to the members of the committee that kind of summarizes some of it as well. First of all, Mr. Backstrom regrets that he's unable to return this afternoon. He did have a conflict that he could not avoid. First of all, Mr. Backstrom wants me to respond to the reference of prior testimony before the Senate Health Committee concerning the same proposal last month, which was raised by the witness yesterday, in which Mr. Backstrom has been told is being circulated by the lobbyists working to pass the medical marijuana bill as a reason for supporting the passage. Mr. Backstrom does not recall answering any specific questions concerning whether the law should be equally go after a cancer patient smoking a joint in a hospice setting or a meth dealer on the street, as has been reported, and if he did so mistakenly, and it was taken out of context. What he was trying to do was to emphasize his importance regarding marijuana and the effects of marijuana on the community. This law enforcement, while law enforcement has no intention of singling out hospice, it does remember and patients who use medical marijuana. Marijuana is a significant situation. I have been with the Dakota County Attorney's Office since 1985, over 20 years. I have been directly involved in the prosecution of individuals for drug offenses, including marijuana, probably over thousands of them. In my 20 years, and as Mr. Backstrom has indicated in his comments, we have never, to my knowledge, ever prosecuted anyone for the medical use of marijuana. If we did discover that that was being used, it was incidental to another investigation. I also sit on, or have sat on, the Narcotics Enforcement Coordinating Committee, which is a committee statewide which oversaw operations by drug task forces around the state of Minnesota. In review of their annual reports, I have never seen a case like this, where they sought out individuals who are using marijuana for medical purposes. I would also note that I sit on the board of directors of the Dakota County Drug Task Force, supervising their operations, and again, have never seen a situation where we prosecute an individual for the medical use of marijuana. I can tell you as a prosecutor, if that case came across my desk, that would be a significant mitigating factor, probably would affect my decision-making and exercising my discretion not to charge the case, and certainly would be a mitigating factor in the final disposition of the case. I would point out some other things regarding the medical marijuana bill that's currently proposed. It's been suggested that this has changed significantly. It has not changed significantly in this case. I did note with some pleasure or interest that there has been an amendment today regarding the use and what is considered chronic pain and the like. In that handout that was distributed to you, there is an attachment. That attachment is the website from the Oregon, state of Oregon. It indicates in that there have been over 12,000 patient cards issued for the medical use of marijuana. 11,305 were for the general generic language of severe pain. So the vast majority of these are for the general generic language of severe or chronic pain, and naturally that causes us some concern. In fact, the district attorney that we talked to today, Barber, got a medical card for a rotator cuff problem that he was having. So there is some significant concern regarding that. Also, if you look at that further, there are over 40,000 cards issued to the primary care providers in the particular case. So I want to note that for you as well. We did attempt, or there's been some discussions that they have addressed many of the concerns raised by the County Attorney's Association and law enforcement officers regarding this. Back in February 14th, Mr. Baxham provided nine concerns that he had with this particular bill, just on a brief glance at the bill. Not one of them has been addressed to this point in time as you go through the bill as proposed. It does cause significant concerns that have been discussed a little bit regarding federal and state and the relationships of state law enforcement officers and federal law enforcement officers. I would ask the members of the committee to take note that our local law enforcement officers and state law enforcement officers work very, very closely with federal officers and federal agents in the enforcement of our drug laws. They share intelligence information, and they have to work and trust each other on a significant basis. I would point out that the bill as written right now has significant consequences to those state and local law enforcement officials. If they share the information on the bill or regarding the medical practice, they lose their job. They are terminated. Under the bill, we are required to give the marijuana back if it was improperly seized. That's a violation of federal law. Now, I don't think the U.S. Attorney necessarily would prosecute it, but that potential is there, especially when you're looking at organizations that will be growing hundreds of plants of marijuana, and for us to give that back to the individuals once they have proper proof that they were involved for the medical purposes as well. If my boss, Jim Baxter, or the Dakota County Sheriff or other elected law enforcement officials shares that information with federal authorities regarding his knowledge that he may have regarding the medical practice or use of medical practice under the bill, his job is suspended or terminated. I don't know what authority or who's going to do that. He is an elected official, and they are elected officials, but apparently the bill calls for that particular situation. So, again, that's another significant concern. The bill regulates and attempts to regulate our courts in attempting to determine what information may be used against or for the purposes of investigating medical marijuana. We cannot include that information in our particular search warrants under the bill. It's against the law to do so. Opens again law enforcement officers to possible criminal prosecution as well as civil liability as you go through the particular matter. There are several other significant concerns which are outlined in Mr. Baxham's response. I can answer some of the questions sitting in continuing testimony today. For example, there's this impression out there that you have to first go get a card authorized by the state. That is not the case under this particular bill. Under the affirmative defense portion of the bill, you can raise the defense. You don't have to get a card. You can just say, if we enter a residence, we search the residence, we seize marijuana plants, there is no card. It doesn't matter. They can still come forward after the fact and indicate that they using for medical purposes. All they have to do is get a medical expert to do that in the process. Regarding, you know, the question by one of the committee members, well, how do I start this thing up or where do I get my first seed? It's correct that you probably would have to get it illegally in the process, but again, you could then raise the defense after the fact, the medical defense in the particular case. There are significant concerns regarding this, regarding separation of powers, regarding sovereignty between state and federal authorities. I did confirm with the U.S. Attorney's Office today that at least theoretically, there could be prosecution, federal prosecution. Again, realistically, whether that would occur may be another statement, but theoretically, there could be federal prosecution of local officials or officers for failure to comply with the statute, as well as I indicated earlier under the legislation. Significant civil liability may exist for the improper arrest of an individual, loss of job, and termination of jobs. If you do have any other questions, I'll be happy to answer them and address them. As I do indicate, I do have been involved in the practice for quite a while. So.
Thank you, and again, apologies, you weren't recognized earlier. It appears that many of your issues are ones that will be appropriate to the next committee, and you'll have another opportunity to present those.
And I understand that, Representative, and that the real key, I think, was some of the issues regarding the use, which is on the attachment from the Oregon. We want to make sure that we got that out in front of the committee members.
Thank you. President Polly.
Quickly. Mr. Chair and Mr. Procopo.
Procopo.
I have to work on that one. I'd actually like to talk to you between now and the next meeting. I think some of these things we could, you and I would probably agree on. Some of them, certainly not all. And would shorten up the next meeting if I had an amendment on the things that you and I could agree on.
Okay, thank you. President Root, we're going to take House File 1074 off the table. Representative Ammer, do you have an amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Let us know what your amendment is.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the following amendment. I would move to strike Subdivision 5, which are lines 1.22 through line 1.24 on page 1. And I think I need to do these all together so they make okay. sense.
So 1.22, so subdivision 5, decedent.
Subdivision 5,
okay.
The definition of decedent, I would move to strike. Then on page 17, line 17.26, where it says, it's the repealer, section 25, where it says sections 525.91, the very first one you see.
0.921?
0.921,
yes.
That would be with the exception of subdivision 3.
Okay.
And then subdivision 3 of 525.921 would have to be renumbered as subdivision 5 under section 2 of the bill.
And do I take it that that's the definition of decedent in the current law?
That is correct. Do you want me to read that so it's clear?
Does everybody have that? Basically, we're keeping the definition of decedent of current law instead of changing it.
Yeah, and then you want to hear why?
I would, yes, but staff has that?
Staff.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the bill that was proposed defines decedent to include a deceased individual whose body or part is or may be the source of an anatomical gift. But then it goes on to say the term includes a stillborn infant and, subject to restrictions imposed by other law, a fetus. The definition currently in law reads that a decedent means a deceased individual and includes a stillborn infant or an embryo or fetus that has died of natural causes in utero. I want to thank Representative Rood, because I don't think any of us, and I apologize for just picking up on it while we were at the table, and the folks that have testified to it, I don't think any of us had really looked at it that close. Somebody brought out the committee's notes that made it clear that the committee, in scrutinizing how this was going to work, was discussing the moral ethical dilemma of stem cells and cloning. I think it's cloning. I will read you out of the notes, and I'll provide it to staff that were given to us. By its terms, this act is silent on the issue of the use or donation of blastocytes and embryos, neither authorizing nor prohibiting their donation or use. Similarly, this act is silent on the nature of the research to be performed and provides no authorization or prohibition for somatic cell nuclear transfer or other specific research techniques. The complicated legal, scientific, moral, and ethical issues which may arise in the consideration of such research is or should be dealt with in separate statutes and policies. With that in mind, the difference between the two is that we've gone back, we're proposing by the amendment to go back to the original language, which would require only an unborn fetus who was passed of natural causes to be used under the Act. And I will also add, in after we have a vote on it, that Representative Rood and the others that support this, even though I understand her motion is going to be to send this to the floor, they have kindly agreed to sit down with us and work through and make sure that we all understand what any moral, ethical, or other considerations might be before it actually comes up. So with that, I'd ask for support on the amendment.
And Representative Root.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Emmer. It has been suggested that perhaps if we insert the existing language into the language that was stricken, it will help keep things in order. I don't know.
Whatever she wants to do.
Good suggestion. Yes.
I didn't come up with it.
All right. Thank you.
So, thank you. That would be fine. And I appreciate Representative Emmer's work on this, and I am committed to continuing to work on this. This is a bill about giving life, and we just want to make sure that's what we're doing.
He's keeping the repeater.
Yeah, we'll get it worked out. Okay. You're going to take the repealer. You'll keep the repealer there and insert the language.
Mr. Chair, I would adopt that proposed language by Representative Rood and to Professor Davies. I must have missed that day in your class.
So, all in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Amendment is adopted. Further discussion, members? Seeing none, Representative Rood renews her motion that House File 1074 be recommended to pass with her commitment to talk and re-refer to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion is adopted, and we are going to adjourn, members. We'll take the other bill up at a later date.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're adjourned.